to agenda paper 5, IFRS 1.
So agenda paper 5 discusses a request relating to the application of IFRS 1 when a subsidiary adopts IFRS standards later than its parent. More specifically, the request asks whether applying to paragraph D16 of IFRS 1, the subsidiary is permitted to measure its cumulative translation differences at the amount that would be included in the parent's consolidated financial statements based on the parent's date of translation of IFRS. The fact pattern included in the submission is summarized in paragraph 7 of the paper. Our analysis of the request based on the existing requirements is included in paragraphs 14 to 17 of the paper. We think that paragraph D16 does not allow such a subsidiary to measure the opening balance of cumulative translation differences based on the parent's date of transition to IFRS. This is because paragraph D16 specifically mentions assets and liabilities, but not equity. We also considered what the board intended when it developed IFRS 1, who would benefit from an exemption for cumulative translation differences, and the cost of applying the existing requirements. Our analysis is included in paragraphs 18 to 27 of the paper. Based on the analysis, we do not recommend proposing a change to IFRS 1 to specifically allow an entity to apply the exemption in paragraph D16 to cumulative translation differences for the reasons described in paragraph 27 of the paper. Last week, we had a GPF meeting, and we asked GPF members whether they'd seen a situation in submission in practice, and if so, the accounting treatment applied. And GPF members indicated that they did not find this instance to be common. Some members said that standard setting is not needed in this respect. One GPF member thought that in such a situation, a subsidiary should be able to use the same amount of cumulative translation differences in its financial statements that is reported to the parent. In our view, the requirements in IFRS provide an adequate basis for a subsidiary to determine how to measure cumulative translation differences at its date of transition to IFRS. Consequently, we recommend that the committee does not add this issue to its agenda. Questions for the committee are on page 9 and ask whether you agree with the staff recommendation not to add this issue onto its agenda, and if so, whether you have any comments on the proposed wording of the tentative agenda decision in Appendix A. I hand over to the committee for discussion.
Sorry, and I'm sure everybody's aware, but just in case you're not aware of GPF, that's our Global Preparers Forum, so it's our advisory body to the board that is made up of Google.
Thank you. I agreed with the staff. I thought D16 was pretty clear in terms of how you were prepared. I didn't find any of the arguments in view to convince me anywhere else in terms of that. So I'd agree. I agree with the paper and I agree with the agenda decision. One thing on the other hand I just want to point out, though, is I had sympathy for the submitter. I mean, I think that there's very much a pervasive issue in IFRS 1 that there's the attempt to eliminate as far as possible the reconciling differences between these two. And I do accept that in BC62 the board discussed that and accepted that we'll eliminate where we can, but there's still the intention that there will be some. But I guess the comment I'd made on this was I'd be interested to see what the comments on the agenda decision come back and say. I would agree with not us not taking on anything now, with the caveat that I think that we'll get a few comments saying, hang on guys, this is another one of those, yes, it says assets liability, we would love to be able to put this in there. And I think if the comments came back saying that, I could almost be supportive to say I think that we could get to a stage with that. But on the basis of where we are here, I would support it.
Yes, I think that we should look upon this from that we have principle-based standards. I agree that if you read letter by letter, word by word, you come to that conclusion. But if you look on the intention that was to give relief to the preparers in the transition, and my understanding is that, okay, you have investigated that track, and the board actually has said that, but it is also so that there is no thing that says the opposite from the board, that it should not be that as a basic principle, that it should be easier for the preparers to do the transition. And in this case, of course, this is a small issue maybe, but that will turn up far in the future. So if you did the transition and you have the asset and liabilities, that would be a problem now, and everyone understands that there is a difference. But this will be a difference maybe in 10 years or 20 years in the future, that you should have these two sets of data. So in my mind, a principle-based standard and an interpretation committee that interpret the principles should come to another conclusion.
I have sympathy, part of me has sympathy for carrying over the parents' CTA into this. And we do see this quite a bit, especially in carve-out situations. But I agree with the staff. I think the analysis is clear. I think it's as laid out in the tentative agenda decision. And while I started out with, while I have sympathy and kind of wish it was, that it's not of such an extent that I would, that I'm seeking an amendment. So I agree with the agenda decision.
Bonnie. So I had a bit of heartburn about this, primarily from a preparer's standpoint, and just given some of the situations that I personally encountered in keeping multiple sets of book, multiple sets of purchase accounting, because IFRS does not allow push-down accounting, which makes it even more challenging. And so I think, you know, there's a couple of points that maybe I wanted to make. One is I think that the example is a very simplified example, and it doesn't take into account the complexities that a global multinational would have in determining the CTA and keeping two sets of books. I think, you know, there is an argument that they were potentially keeping two sets of books anyway, but if, you know, one of the rationales of a sub going to IFRS is likely to align as close to the parent as possible to eliminate some of that additional work, the additional controls, potentially additional audit effort around that. This, I think, does create some issues with that. The other questions that I had was, this only addressed one potential difference. What about for pensions? What about potentially for derivatives, revaluation of PP&E, the other things that could show up in equity in terms of revaluation and other things? So I struggled with this one a bit. I think this is what the guidance probably says. I think it's a very practical issue that can be seen in situations, and I think the effort of maintaining two sets of books in a very controlled environment can be quite challenging.
I think it was helpful if we can talk about what the words say and then what people think about whether they like the outcome or not, because they're two slightly different things. And I think to Bruce's suggestion, if people agree with the meaning of the words and we put that out, when we get responses, we then have the ability to assess whether people think it's a big enough deal for us to do something subsequent with it.
I think I may have some of the same comments as Mikhail, that I read the specific words, but it was a bit troubling to me that the words ended up being assets and liabilities, but there wasn't any rationale as to why that was when there was a change in the drafting to what the final words were. And I think that's, given all these practical questions, that was one of the things that I struggled with, is from a principles base, do you really just read the words assets and liabilities, or do you look at what the intention of the relief is? So, and I know there are some very specific exemptions and accommodations that are in IFRS 1. So I understand that you can't apply by analogy some of these things. So I understand your point, Sue. I think these are the points that I want to make sure are raised in the discussion.
Yeah, and I was really partly asking you whether you thought the words were clear or whether you thought just so that everybody's
yep, that's fair.
So that's helpful.
Yep, that's fair.
Yeah. For the words, I would say yes. I agree with the staff conclusion based on the current wording IFRS 1. At the same time, I would rather disagree with the staff assessments on the first sentence in paragraph 26. Each time you have to maintain two sets of records, it's burdensome. And then, having said that, would it be a major problem to amend IFRS 1 to introduce an option on the accounting for CTDs in such instance, so that the company there could retain the amount of CTDs that was in the previously in its consolidation package, and we could, I think, rather easily add this option to paragraph D13, or eventually, because the discussion focused on D16, but then D16 might enlarge the issue, as Bonnie said, to more than CTDs, but at least for CTDs, effectively, it could be a good thing, at a minimum for CTDs, to amend D13 to add this third option. And I don't see why it should be a major problem, as this amendment would be consistent with the mere principles contained in D16. And then, effectively, we could have a look to eventually to widen the scope by amending directly D16. But for sure, it would be an ease each time you have a carve-out. Notably, it would be an ease to be in a position to retain the values that were previously expressed in the consolidation package that was reported to the parent entity.
Yeah, I just want to concur about Bonnie's comment. If we strictly read the standard itself, especially paragraph D16, we can get the same conclusion as the staff conclusion. But I want to say that there are many different components in equity. Some of the components are from the profits or loss. Some of the components are from the transactions with the shareholders. But some of the components are from the evaluation of the assets and liabilities. CTD is a result of the translation of assets and liabilities. As Bonnie said, there are some others like the revaluation surplus from the assets, property, plant, and equipment. So if we just follow the standard of paragraph 16, then it means that we just follow the rule, not the principle. So I just want to ask, what is the principle on the line here? As Bonnie said, you know, why assets and liabilities are not explained the standard at all? If you think about what is the real, I mean, where does that CTD come from? It comes from the assets and liabilities. And if we just make a conclusion like this, maybe this conclusion is going to be applied to many other asset valuation-based, you know, equity, such as the revaluation surplus of the property platform. And so that this issue, I think, is not a small issue. It could be expanded to many other.
Well, I suppose I just wanted to, clarify a few points about that, and maybe clarify our thought process, not to say or only to explain it. I suppose in a couple of respects is that, that of course what we sort of viewed our job as first and foremost is if we get a question is what you know, let's try and be clear about whether we think the words are clear and what they you know, say or want us to do. And I suppose at least the starting point is to think is that what's often helpful, as we say, in maybe understanding the requirements or the words, is to look at the basis in terms of what the board explained, what's the rationale behind the requirements. But of course, the basis can never be used to override the words that are written, because the words are authoritative and the basis is just providing more information, I suppose, behind that. The other thing I wanted to clarify is, and I'm only trying to say that I think that possibly part of our thinking was that often if you have potential differences in how you actually measure the assets and liabilities itself, that's where a big part of the difficulty in tracking can come. I can only imagine that Bertrand and what you and Bonnie are saying is right, because actually it's not just that you might have a difference, say, in the first date that you apply I4S, that can create other differences going forward, say, in depreciation each year or whatever. So I get, you know, I understand that very much. And then when I think that what's important to say is what D16 already allows is that you can start with the same numbers on your asset and liability point. So to the point you raised, Jiangsu, it's right to say that the other side of some of the measurement of an asset might be the revaluation reserve, but just to be clear, what D16 says is the asset and liability numbers that's submitted can be exactly the numbers that are reported, you know, to the parent. What where simply you might have where you might have a difference is in those opening numbers that are within the equity section. So at least what D16 I think says is it says you can use the same asset and liability numbers. So it's just about saying what are the opening amounts that I put in opening retained earnings versus what do I put in some of the opening reserves. And I suppose the other point I was just going to make is that again, I certainly don't want to comment and say that it's not difficult at all to keep two sets of records because certainly that wouldn't be appropriate. But I suppose one of the focal points that we had around, you know, this one is that we felt, given the narrowness of the question, and we're just talking about the currency translation reserve, that at least it would be a static day one difference in a sense. So it's not that this difference on day one would constantly need, you know, possibly could differ over the course afterwards. Now, it would be a static day one difference across for each foreign operation. It's not just necessarily one amount, but you would have to be tracking your currency translation reserve for each foreign operation in any event. So it's not to downplay it and say that there's no cost, but at least we felt there was lower cost associated with just having a sort of day one difference that stays the same until the point you dispose of it, as opposed to having, you know, a difference that might end up, you know, becoming a different difference in a sense and having to track things quite differently. And I suppose just the last point I was going to think is that almost for all of the reasons that you've said is that, and I think we would say that if we thought there was possibly some amendment that would just focus on the currency translation reserve, then potentially that's quite a quick thing, you know, a narrow thing that could be done sort of with relative ease in IFRS 1, possibly with any sort of unintended consequences. But I think all I would say is I fear is that for all, you know, good reasons you've said, if we thought we should do that, well, maybe wider, shouldn't we look at whether there's also other differences that we should never look at closing off? We should pick up all the other reserves in equity. I think then that potentially could become quite a big thing that maybe has lots of tentacles elsewhere and might sort of almost warrant a more fundamental re-look at IFRS 1 and how it works. So I suppose I would just worry that you know, if we started to open it up, it could become something big, more sort of wider around IFRS 1.
Gary.
Yeah, thank you. Ask a question of the preparers on the table, you know, that spoke, and anyone can respond. And as this is coming from a more or less a career preparer, so you're going to probably think I went over to the other side, but I really didn't. Yet, on this one, if you think of the closing of the books, you know, today you already feed the parent company, presumably monthly, on parent company's basis, which is their version of IFRS. And you've got other books, you know, your local tax books, you've got your parent company's tax books, then you've got once a year, if you will, statutory reporting. And again, this, my comment works better when you're a wholly owned subsidiary and you don't have any NCIs or other sort of public accountability. Is I would have to think, since you're going to retire your local GAAP and pick up IFRS, I mean, it might be some more work to keep the initial translation difference, but it's not like it's two entirely brand new set of books, because most of the assets and liabilities are just going to be the parent basis you're feeding. So I think between you kid, you kind of get this frozen number up front. So it might be more work, but I think retiring much of the local GAAP, you know, there's a benefit to that. So that's how I sort of hear it, and I'm just inviting an alternative view, or what am I missing or something, because I just can't imagine it's that much extra work. And by the way, I would agree, if you know, IFRS 1, the 30 or so exemptions mandatory, you know, would that be the list we'd write today, 15 years later? I don't know, you know, but that's a much bigger project, and that is did not, I can assure you, make the agenda consultation. But, you know, it does raise, you know, every year there's fewer and fewer first-time adopters left in the world to adopt, you know, and at some point we maybe way down the line, it probably gets appropriate to consider its continuing broad-based applicability for 150 countries. Whatever.
Thanks. Tony.
So, agree with the staff analysis of what IFRS 1 says. It says assets and liabilities, and it says that you shouldn't apply the exemptions by analogy. So I agree with the technical analysis of where the staff has got to. Just reflecting on some of the comments about whether that's a good place to be, my sense is that keeping the two sets of books could be a challenge. If you think about a group that has a lot of subsidiaries, you end up potentially selling some or selling some businesses or whatever. So yes, the difference is static, but it's in a lot of cases it's not a single static number. Yeah. If you've got a big group, you reorganize it, you move things around, you sell things. So it could be a challenge. Where I do agree with the staff, just based on experience, is this is not a question I've seen very often at all. And so it's probably a relatively narrow range of companies that get affected by it. But I can see how the effect could be relatively significant if it does affect a particular company. I think I share Katrina's concern and responding to what Bonnie said. If we were to think about making a change for this, does that potentially open the door to thinking about other aspects of IFRS 1 that didn't get considered? What are there any other things that are bugging people? So I guess in summary, I agree with where the staff has got to, and I would want to understand the broader consequences before we would think about taking on a potential broader consequences on an amendment.
John.
I agree with the staff analysis, the technical analysis. I think the words are quite clear in what they say. I do think the statement in paragraph 24 that it's not expected to be affect many entities, I don't agree with that. It actually, you see it in carve-outs and spin-offs for people who are first-time adopters. You see it as certain jurisdictions move their national gap to IFRS. There's a lot of first-time adoption going on outside of the listed company space around the world, and it also is applicable to equity method in separate financial statements, which again is you have CTA arising as a result of the application of the equity method. So I do think this is much broader. So I really don't agree with the thing that it's only very few entities. I certainly wouldn't find a proposal to change objectionable. I mean, I think it seems to make sense. One of the things we'd have to consider is there are different ways of looking at CTD. I think we've already, in the development of IFRIC 16, it was acknowledged that CTD can either be the translation from the subsidiaries directly to the parent's functional currency, or it can actually be the translation through sub-parents. And you can actually look at the cumulative translation difference as made up differently, either direct translation to the functional currency of the parent or intermediate translation. So would your view on what the CTD is made up of affect the availability of any exemption under IFRS 1? We would have to address that question if we were actually looking to amend IFRS 1.
Andrew.
So to the first question, I think the staff have got it right, and that's what IFRS 1 says. I think that my hesitation, just picking up some comments from around the table, is that I'm not necessarily convinced that everyone will have read it as precisely as that. So there might be something lurking in the undergrowth here. And perhaps that also links into a view that perhaps when you look at equity, IFRS doesn't deal with equity as wonderfully as it does with assets and liabilities. Now, I don't know why the board changed IFRS, it did, but equity is always regarded as a residual that seems to be just put to one side. There's also the question of, on the comments of what you do with other parts of equity in IFRS 1, well, there are some components of equity like this that you do recycle, and there are others that you don't, you just transfer within equity. I don't quite know how far down the track you would go, but there is a question of just which bits of equity you might find other questions coming in on. It might not be quite as pervasive as we might think. In common with others, I think this may be a little bit more widespread than we anticipate, because in many jurisdictions, it's parent companies and consolidated financial statements that do IFRS, and you have local GAAP underneath. And we still see subsidiaries and other companies coming on board onto IFRS. So I think it's an ongoing issue, and one which probably isn't going to go away. I might be in rather the same place as Bruce and say, well, let's see what comes back in the comment letters. But I think it's certainly worth thinking about what we might do with this. But I very much agree with where the staff have got to in the technical level.
Thank you, Andrew. Reinhardt.
I won't be long. I agree with the staff analysis. I think the words are clear. I'm hesitant to expand or take on a project to modify or change IFRS 1 because of some of the knock-on effects and other components of equity. I think we'd also need to think about circumstances where the parent acquired the intermediate subsidiary at a date other than when the subsidiary acquired its own subsidiaries, because there will always be differences in that respect. Just like you have the differences that on the assets of the parent that you need to consider from an IFRS 1 perspective. So it's a potentially a very broad issue, and as Tony said, maybe if we had a clean sheet of paper started over with IFRS 1, we might end up at a different spot. But I'm not. Although I agree with the comments that we see this very commonly, because you see it in spin-offs, carve-out finance statements quite frequently. I'm not sure it's a pervasive enough issue to address at this time.
Thank you. Back to the preparers now. Bonnie.
So just a couple of cautions. It sounds like everyone else thinks the words are clear in this, so just a couple of cautions. And that's, you know, maybe to answer Gary's question, this is only one difference. There are other basis differences, particularly if you have purchase accounting. There can be even presentation differences, all of which make it very complex to keep two sets of books and records. And if a subsidiary is going to IFRS, they are looking for those benefits and looking for taking the parent's basis, eliminating any of these differences so that they can streamline the accounting and reporting. And to the extent you have these things that are popping out, it just creates other issues. So I think that if we proceed, I think the caution that I would have is, will preparers take this analysis and apply it to other pieces of equity, the revaluation of PP&E, the other things, and say, does that also apply here, even though we're just asking about one specific thing, which is the CTA adjustment. So if that's what we intend, then so be it. If we don't think that's the right conclusion for maybe other similar questions, then perhaps we need to further think about how to address those specific items. So I'm, to Sue's original question, I don't know that I like where the standard has got to, and I don't like the fact that there's not pushed down accounting in IFRS, but those are two completely separate issues than what the paper is discussing at this point.
Thanks.
If I combine a couple of comments that were made, So I liked what John said, that effectively it's something that can happen frequently. And notably, the question would arise when you do a carve-out or within your group by listing separately one of your business units, and you still consolidate or you still equity account for the subsidiary afterwards. So, and that can happen quite often. I liked also your comment, Patrina, when you said that effectively the value of the assets and the liabilities themselves would be might be unchanged in the two sets of books. So effectively, I mean, it's an important thing. And I liked also Tony's comment saying that the problem will be more in the potential P&L effects that might be different in the two sets of books. And so if you combine the three, you end up saying, honestly, the issue lies more on the recycling OCI, mostly. And obviously, the most significant component of it is currency translation differences. So by dealing with currency and just narrowing the change to the CTDs, you would already provide a relief for the preparers that might be potentially concerned by this issue at a minimum. So just amending narrowly D13, and then obviously you don't do by analogy, you can effectively precise that. It would provide at least this already a relief, and quite a major one, I think.
I was going to try and wrap up and suggest a way forward, but Mary, did you want to come in?
I did. It actually not a direct follow-up on Bertrand's comments, but just reflecting on some of the earlier concern expressed with, is this too mechanical a reading when there seems to be a more general principle? And I'm about to do something that is not very reliable, which is rely on my memory. At the time that IFRS 1, the section of IFRS 1 was being developed, I think, first of all, the board came late to thinking about this issue about subsidiaries adopting after their parent, but decided to address it as part of the project. But and I think that comment in the basis, the original comment about simplifying and streamlining is a good capture of why they started to look at this. But I think the board was pretty conscious as it finalized IFRS 1 about in each case balancing the loss of comparability with the degree of relief, so that I think the package that you see that seems sometimes to be very kind of rules, we decided this but not that, this, rather than carrying through a principle consistently, relates back to the board finalizing the standard and trying to take in and evaluate information it got in the consultation about what the effects are. So I think in this case I would take what some people see as the principle as the board's starting point for why they were looking at this, rather than the overarching principle that, if you read it now, might seem to not be fully reflected. So just caution in that regard about saying, are we getting too narrow a reading? I would assume that these decisions were conscious.
And I suspect that's why we have the words, as a reminder not to analogize, because it was sort of a list. Okay. So given all of that, in terms of what we've been asked this very specific question about the application of IFRS 1 and this fact pattern, and I think that to be helpful to the person who's asked the question and others in their position, in the first instance they want a message from the committee in terms of what we think the words say. I think a number of people are reacting differently to whether they like that's what the words say. But if we could, I think what might be good to do, and I'll see if the committee agrees, would be to go forward with something along the lines of the tentative agenda decision, subject to talking about the words next, to confirm the reading of the standard if the committee as a whole agrees with the staff's reading of the standard. when we get comments back, that will give us a new set of information that we could use at that time to assess whether, as a subsequent step, there would be it would be appropriate to consider whether we should make amendments. But at least in the first instance, we'd be confirming what the words say today, which helps people. And then if we were to get feedback from people that it is more burdensome than perhaps we had thought about, we could, the staff could have a look at that as part of the comment analysis. But I think then, in doing that, we'd need to think more carefully about what the knock-ons might be of starting to sort of pull a thread in that, in what we've already got in IFRS 1. So that's a very long-winded way of leading into asking the committee whether they can agree with the, well, the staff analysis in the first instance. If I could have a show of hands, please.
Sorry, can you repeat your question again, Sue?
Agree with the staff analysis.
Agree with the staff analysis. Okay, so that's everyone except two. Okay, so as a next step then, I need to ask whether the committee wants, it would agree to not adding the issue to its standard setting agenda, but rather proceeding with a tentative agenda decision as a way of addressing this issue. And then we'll talk about the words, but in principle, can I have a show of hands on that? Well, thank you. So that was everybody, so thank you for those who don't really like that part. and then I guess if I hand back to Takashi, do you want to see whether there's any specific wording suggestions that we should have a look at? No?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Right. We're running ahead of schedule, but what we'll do is keep moving with the agenda items, so we'll move now. Have to do a shuffle and see.
Yes, I did.